They turned to Chuck. "You know how to open a baler?" The Sandy Van Dyke smiled back. "Born to it. Go crack that one open and check the contents, and then split the last two bales northbound. If she was walking or running from somebody, then she might have dropped her purse or something along the way." Freimeyer paused for a moment, and I looked at him. "You need help?" He glanced back at the one-ton bales. "Yes." I looked at Double Tough, and he started off with Chuck. There was still a lot of light. It was like that in the summer this far north. And you could plainly see where the young woman had played out the last moments of her life. She was provocatively dressed, inappropriate for the surroundings. She had on a short skirt, a pink halter top, and no shoes. Her long dark hair was tangled with the grasses. It had been blown by the ever-prevalent Wyoming wind, and you could see her delicate bone structure. The eyes were closed, and you might have thought she was asleep, but for the blue coloring in her face and a swollen eye, and the fact that from the angle it was apparent that her neck had been broken. I listened as Cox came up and squatted down beside me. "You losing weight?" "Yep, I'm in the gym with Katie every day." He nodded. "How's she doing?" "She's good, Carl. Thank you for asking. Hey, speaking of Katie, could I get you to have Rosie call into our dispatch and ask them to tell her I won't be coming home tonight?"
"You bet."
He tipped his campaign hat back. "DCI is on the way. I think you got the Wicked Witch of the West herself." I nodded. T.J. Sherwin was always looking for a reason to come up to the mountains in the summertime. The division lieutenant plucked a piece of the prairie and placed the harvested end in his mouth. "We checked all the way back to Casper, Walt, but no abandoned vehicles." He glanced after my deputies. "Your guy's going to check the baler?"
"Yep."
"Good. My guys wouldn't know which end to look in." He studied the body of the dead girl, and then looked up at me. "I've got men checking all the Chinese restaurants in Sheridan, Casper, and Gillette to see if anybody's missing. Don't bother." I ran my hand over my face. "She's Vietnamese." Chapter 2. She wasn't walking, not without shoes. T.J. Sherwin watched as the technicians zipped up the black plastic bag and carefully placed the Asian woman's body onto a gurney under the constant racket of the generators. The flat yellow shine of the emergency lights made even the living look jaundiced. I closed my eyes. Fresh? It was getting late and the warmth of the sun was long gone, replaced by the stars and the clear, cool air creeping down from the Bighorn Mountains. It hadn't rained in more than a month. She hugged herself. Less than 12 hours. I put my arm around her because I wanted to keep her warm and because I wanted to. She'd been the chief forensic pathologist for Wyoming's Division of Criminal Investigation for half of my tenure in Absaroka County. She'd thought me antiquated, but in 17 years, I'd grown on her. She wasn't killed here. Preliminary says asphyxiation, manual strangulation by someone very powerful. Whoever it was, they started by strangling her and then broke her neck. They didn't do a very good job of hiding the body. I could feel her eyes on me. No, they didn't. I took a quick look ahead to the county road toward the highway. There's an exit only a mile up. I looked at the uncut grass on the other side of the culvert. We'll have to look for drag marks or footprints farther north. We're going to need to check the roadside back to 249 and down to 246 at the South Fork of the Powder. She shivered and snuggled closer under my arm. My guy's about through with the bales. She snickered. They're going to love you.
Yep.
I watched as the bag boys loaded the dead woman into the Suburban for transport to Cheyenne.
So you're not going to stick around?
Too much to do. She left my protection and started back up the slope toward the emergency vehicles, splaying their revolving blue, red, and yellow lights across the wildflowers that were blooming under the sage. I started to follow but stopped, sighed to myself, and called after her. "Anybody checked that thing yet?" She turned back to me. "The tunnel? No, I think they were going to wait until daylight."
"You want company?"
Double Tough gave me his mag light. I took half an egg sandwich and shook my head. Nope. The food had just arrived, and I knew they were hungry. I figured I could prowl around on my own. But I'll take one of those cups of coffee. It was a clear night, and the full moon and thick swath of the Milky Way gave plenty of illumination on the area surrounding the tunnel, if not the hole itself. I threw a leg over a guardrail and started down the embankment to the entrance on the other side of Lone Bear Road. I wasn't expecting to find a culprit shivering at the mouth of the thing. I figured that whoever had killed the young woman had walked back to his vehicle and driven away. But it never hurt to look. I opened the styrofoam cup, shook off the lid, and stuffed it in my back jeans pocket in an attempt to keep Absaroka County clean, and stepped down into the 3/4 inch of Murphy Creek. I sipped the coffee, listened to the distant sound of the 18-wheel trucks on I-25, and shone the beam of the 4-cell flashlight into the black opening of the drainage tunnel. There was something blocking a complete view of the other side. I took a step and listened to it resound off the hardened walls of the concrete. In the most likely scenario, it was a yearling that had followed the creek bed and gotten stuck or confused. Few things in the natural world are as easily confused as a heifer. Just ask any cowboy. There were some rabbit carcasses and a few deer bones a little farther into the tunnel, and I could see that there were some broken pieces of 2x4s and truck skids piled at one side with a collection of blankets, tarps, and cardboard boxes gathered on them. It was possibly the regular flotsam and jetsam of Murphy Creek, but I didn't think the water flow was that strong. I thought I'd seen a small movement, but it was probably the shadows of the flashlight. The refuse pile smelled like something dead, and got worse as I leaned in closer and nudged one of the blanket layers of the sofa-sized bundle. More cardboard. Something must have been using the blockage as a nest, and the stench made my eyes water. An old warning bell went off, so I transferred my cup of coffee to the flashlight hand and pulled the Colt 1911 out and to the right, cocked and locked. I clicked off the safety and stooped down as close as I dared, recognizing the quilt as a packing blanket from a rental truck place. I had pulled my sidearm on a pile of trash. I started to re-safety and reholster my weapon when something in the pile shifted, and the entire collection of blankets, cardboard, and smell exploded straight at me, lifting me completely off the ground and against the far side of the tunnel. The flashlight disappeared, coffee went everywhere, and the .45 in my hand fired as my fingers contracted on impact with the cement wall. The compressed sound of the big Colt plugged my ears like a set of fingers. All the air in my body hung there as I fell forward. Whatever it was bigger than me and hairy, and it caught me by my chest and pushed me back. It was roaring in my face as it slapped me, the Colt splashing into the water. My head felt like it was coming apart, but I thrashed at whatever it was, bringing my arms forward and kicking with my legs. It pressed against me with the force of a front-end loader. My only hope was to get away from the thing before it sunk its claws into me or took off half my face in one bite. I got a lucky punch at its head, but it still threw me sideways where I slid along in the muck. The thought of being mauled to death or eaten alive in the darkness of an irrigation tunnel renewed my fortitude for fighting. I leveraged a fist loose and brought it forward with all the force my clumsy position would allow. There was a bit of a lull, and I took advantage and raised my head, but it was back on me in an instant. I shouldn't have exposed my throat because it started to choke me. I flailed with both fists, but I might as well have been striking the concrete floor. I kicked, but the weight of the thing held me solid, and I was just beginning to feel the blood vessels in my head explode and my vision fail. I could see flashes of light where there were none, and I could see faces in the flashes, women, they were all women. I could see my mother on a grassy hillside, the summer sun shining through the sides of her pale blue eyes. I saw my wife, the first time I asked her to dance, and the gentle way her fingers first reached for mine. I saw Victoria Moretti lowering her face to me with her bathrobe undone. I saw my daughter, her determined look in the weight room, and could only think, "It's okay, Daddy." There was splashing, and there were other voices above the roaring of whatever had me and whatever I had. I made one last struggle to bury my thumbs into the front of its throat and could just feel my fingers making headway into the fragile egg-carton-like cartilage of its larynx, a method I'd used to stay alive in Quezon. If I was going to die, something was going with me. I heard a loud crack and felt a shift in the thing's weight as it toppled to one side, just before the women's faces disappeared and it all faded to black. I sat there on the bank of the hillside as the EMTs worked on the back of my head. I continued to clear my throat and massaged my forefinger and thumb into my eye sockets in an attempt to replace the stars in my eyes with real ones. Doubletuff stood by as TJ handed me another cup of coffee. I wasn't sure I could swallow it, but it was reassuring just to be able to hold it. We all watched the faint glow of the sunrise and the horizon toward Pumpkin Buttes and Thunder Basin. I nodded thanks and cleared my throat, still unable to speak. TJ glanced back at the EMTs who were finishing up the job.
"I assume he's going to be okay?"
Kathy leaned around and looked at the front of me as she finished doctoring the back of my head. "The long arm of the law is going to have a lump, but we've patched him up before." Doubletuff smiled his slow grin and looked across the grassland to the wall of red rocks.
"Lord almighty, you see the size of that son of a bitch?"
I swallowed and tried a sip. It tasted pretty good, but set off another coughing attack.
"What did you use to get him off me?"
My voice sounded rough and wheezy.
"One of them pieces of 2x4.
He thought about it as Kathy and Chris gathered up the rest of their equipment to change venue.
"I think you surprised him."
"Not as much as he surprised me." The creature from the cave was as big as a grizzly, and it took 4 men to carry him out of the tunnel. I noticed they used ankle bracelets at his wrists because the handcuffs would have been too small. He was an Indian. Crow from what we could make of him. I started to get up, but felt a little dizzy and sat back down. TJ placed a hand on my shoulder and held me there.
"Easy."
I sighed.
"He's still alive?"
Doubletuff snorted.
"Yeah, I hit him hard enough to fell a mule, but he's still breathing."
I watched as Chris, Chuck, and the 2 HPs carried the now unconscious man up the hillside, his hair trailing all the way to the grass, snagging here and there, as if it were trying to stay the progress. It was as if his hair, like the Vietnamese girls, had wanted to remain here until all the questions had been answered. He was wearing an old army field jacket, torn and ragged, with the remnants of a denim shirt and a wool sweater underneath. His legs were swathed in tatters of plaid-lined overalls. Everything was frayed and filthy, except the intricately beaded moccasins that were on his gigantic feet. They were a design I'd never seen. I tried to stand again, and this time succeeded, and I staggered up the hill with Doubletuff's help.
"Anybody checking all that stuff in the tunnel?"
"They're gonna, but they're not gonna be happy about it. The place smells bad enough to gag a maggot off a gut wagon."
I nodded toward the giant.
"What about him?"
"He's going to the hospital, and then he's most likely going to be in our jail."
"Find anything in the tunnel to connect him with the Vietnamese woman?"
He shook his head at me.
"Not yet, but we figured trying to choke the life out of the sheriff was good enough reason to hold him."
We watched as they loaded the gurney into the EMT van, the rear suspension compressing with the weight of 1 woman, 4 men, and 1 very large Indian.
"You guys knock him out with something?"
Doubletuff gave a half-hearted laugh.
"We didn't have to. You just about collapsed his larynx, and I pretty much battered his head in."
They closed the van doors and departed toward Durant Memorial Hospital. After the sirens died down, he spoke in a soft voice.
"That is 1 FBI.
I didn't bother to translate the acronym, but I knew he didn't mean Federal Bureau of Investigation. TJ had left with her DCI crew and said she'd be in touch as soon as they knew anything. So Rosie gave me a ride back to the office. It was still early morning, and the darkness was slow to release its grip on the county. Ruby, my dispatcher, was always first in, but she was dog-sitting and hadn't gotten there yet. My dog, Dog, still didn't have a name, and after calling him Dog for the better part of a year, I was concerned that he would be confused if I gave him a real name, or maybe I was concerned about confusing myself. I took advantage of the situation to go back to the holding cells, to catch a quick nap on one of the bunks. I tried sleeping on my back, but the damage to the muscles in my throat made me feel like I was strangling. And the little yarmulke of bandages at the back of my head made that position even more uncomfortable, so I rolled over on my side and stared at the bars. Where did he come from? And what was he doing there? If he had killed the woman, why would he have left her in such a conspicuous spot? Why wouldn't he have just dragged her into the tunnel with him? Besides, what the hell was a Vietnamese woman doing in northern Wyoming, especially dead alongside Lone Bear Road? Maybe I'd know more when TJ called with the official report. I thought about the girl's face, the cyanosis discoloration, the hemorrhaging of the skin around the eyes. I guessed there would be small linear abrasions at the throat, either from the perpetrator or from her attempts to dislodge the attacker's arm or hands. I thought about her bone structure, which was the big tip-off as to her nationality. If you spend any time in Southeast Asia, you pick up the basic differences pretty quickly. And I sure had spent time in Vietnam. Tan Son Nhut, Vietnam, 1967. No bo ku, you scat rikki-tikki baby-san. He a Marine and they no boom boom. He a Marine and they no boom boom, just kill. Baranski laughed, enjoying his own charm, elegance, and immense style. I smiled, shrugged at the young woman, and took another swig of my tiger beer, her image swimming in the blown-out sweat and strangeness. She shook her head and placed a provocative leg forward to test the theory. He no killer. Jimi Hendrix's All Along the Watchtower pounded the room as the tiny Vietnamese woman swayed to the driving rhythm. Baranski crossed his ankles on the chair in front of him and belched loud enough to rattle the windows in the Boy Howdy Boku Good Times lounge. If it had had any, windows, that is. The lounge was just outside gate 055, near the old French fort known simply as Hotel California. I had been in California a short while earlier, and, from my perspective, I could not see the resemblance. The concrete walls of the old fort were 20 feet high and 3 feet thick, forming a whitewashed rectangle. Each of the archways had solid iron gates, and I expected Franchatone and his troop of French legionnaires to march through at any minute. There was an Army of the Republic of Vietnam Company posted to the fort, but the real action was just outside the lounge, where there was a civilian mortuary and a cemetery with thousands of white grave markers. It was strange having the local bar next to the cemetery, but I'd seen stranger things since arriving in Vietnam. Boy, howdy. Little sister, you sabe specialists in Uncle Sam's fighting forces? Baranski gestured toward me. This number one killer. She smiled at him and then reconsidered me, but not her opinion. Her eyes were hard, but her smile was dazzling. Good teeth, something you didn't see much over here. What's your name, number one killer? I ambled to a 6 and almost a half-foot standing position as quickly as the heat and 8 tiger beers would allow, all my mother's lessons moving past the alcohol and to the fore. Lieutenant Walt Longmire, ma'am, from the great state of Wyoming. Baranski lit another camel and smiled. Killer, hell, he's a cowboy. Mendoza raised his head just long enough to make one statement. Bullshit. I'm from Texas, man. I'm the cowboy. Baranski removed the cigarette from his mouth and spoke with absolute authority. You're a beaner, asshole. Mendoza's voice was muffled against the sticky surface of the table. What do you know, you fucking hoosier? I turned back to the girl as she snapped a finger and pointed it at me, practiced at diverting conflict. Cowboy better than killer. USA number one. I smiled back. You bet. She laughed a short burst and sought more monetarily advantageous pursuits at the bar, or the row of powder blue 55-gallon fuel drums and plywood that made up the bar. Hey? She glanced back with a lascivious wink. Her voice was husky. You change mine, cowboy? No, miss. I just want to know your name. Her eyes softened, and she turned completely around to make a formal introduction of herself.
"My Kim, I am pleased to make acquaintance."
Her head bowed, and I suddenly felt like a visiting dignitary instead of a marine investigator making the outrageous sum of $479.80 a month. "The pleasure is mine, my Kim." She paused there for a moment, considered the surroundings and her situation, her eyelids slowly blinking in shame, then turned and walked away. She didn't strut. I looked at the landscape of empty bottles to allow her an unstudied retreat, and noticed that there was an old broken-down upright piano beside the bar.
"Tell him to turn down that spook music while you're over there, my Kim,"
Baranski shouted as he took another sip of his 33 export.
"Damn! I've been here for almost 2 months and never knew a name."
I continued to study the piano as a few of the black airmen stared at our table. I set my beer bottle down and looked at Baranski and decided to go right up the middle. "So, what is the local drug problem?" He smiled.
"Not enough drugs, that's the problem."
I didn't smile back, so he felt compelled to continue.
"What have you heard?"
"A lot of personnel are passing through here and turning up self-medicated." He shook his head and sighed.
"That's the Provost Marshal's view?"
I peeled the label of my beer with my thumbnail.
"Yep."
It was silent at the table for a minute.
"Look, this country is crawling with drugs, and a lot of the shit comes from our very own CIA. There's buns growing all over the place, opium in the highlands, and Matuyi heroin is the cottage industry of choice."
He lifted his beer and tipped mine in a toast.
"Pick your poison. Hell, watch this."
He motioned to an Arvin captain, who disengaged from a group at the far end of the bar and promenaded over in polished boots, a sky-blue flight suit, and an honest-to-God white silk scarf. As adjuncts to the USAF, the Vietnamese flyers were allowed a certain amount of freedom in assembling their uniforms, most of which were, well, flamboyant. He smiled and inclined his head to Baranski as the matinee idol turned to me.
"Lieutenant Longmire, this is Hollywood Huang."
The small man extended a hand, and I shook it. His nails were clean, clipped, and polished. His skin lotioned smooth. I figured him for quite the dandy.
"Hollywood here can get you anything you need."
He grinned at the helicopter pilot. "Hollywood, I need to score a pound of legendary Montagnard grass. How much?"
"One carton Marlboro."
His accent had just a touch of French and was remarkably cultured even with the lack of prepositions. He glanced at me.
"This for you, Lieutenant?"
"No." Baranski was laughing.
"You get my point?"
The flyboy interrupted.
"Half carton."
"That's okay, thanks.
Half carton is very good price."
"I'm sure, but I'm really not interested." He gave a slight shrug and smiled.
"If anything you need, I get for you."
I watched him swagger back to the bar and glanced at Baranski. "What's that supposed to mean?"
"Anything. Anything you want, he can get.
He was Central Office of South Vietnam when they were fighting the French, but now he's got ties to the CIA, so whatever you want, he can get it." He watched me as I scraped the rest of the palm tree off my beer label and stared at the table.
"Hey, don't make the long face, Longmire. Battalion headquarters don't know shit. Do you have any idea how many personnel we have going in and out of here every day?"
He leaned back in his chair, waved his cigarette in the air, and laughed.
"This air base is roughly the size of LaGuardia Airport back in the States. We got Air Force, Navy, and Army personnel, not to mention you grunts. We got South Vietnamese, Cambodians, Thais, Laotians, and the odd NVA running through this place every day. Now, do you think we have any idea what they've got with them when they get here? What they have when they leave? Or what they might have left here once they're gone?"
I looked up. "Tough job."
"Impossible is more like it."
He took a deep breath and leaned in, placing his elbows on the table and looking at me over the empties.
"The shit is everywhere. And if you go around asking a bunch of stupid questions and causing a lot of trouble, you're going to end up dead. That's your business."
He pointed a finger at his most recent partner, still passed out on the table. But you might get us killed, too. And that shit is a no-go. You sabe?
I looked at him blankly, still trying to figure it all out.
Look, fucking new guy, I was sent up here 6 weeks ago. I drink too much, smoke too much, bird dog a few, I'll die. He glanced around and then leaned in even closer. And then I got with the program. I'm an investigator with CID.
And then along comes Second Lieutenant Walter Longmire, and we've got a new sheriff in town? Fuck you.
We sat there in silence, looking past each other, listening to the music and the idle chatter at the bar.
Why don't you tell me what it is that's got the bug up battalion's ass, and I'll try to narrow our field of operations.
U.S. Marine PFC James Tooley, of Toledo, Ohio. Baranski thought about it.
Never met him.
The horn section in Rescue Me started up from the jukebox as the blonde man shouted,
"Damn it, I said no more split music!"
A few more of the black soldiers glared at us as I slowly started to stand. "Well, you missed your chance. He died of a heroin overdose in flight from this airbase about 2 weeks ago." He shook his head and motioned for two more beers.
"So let me guess, there's a Governor Tooley or a Senator Tooley back in Ohio that wants to know why his little boy died of a drug overdose in sunny South Vietnam?"
I didn't say anything. I didn't say anything about how James Tooley's father was neither a senator nor a governor, but a night watchman at an automobile parts plant. I didn't say anything about a Marine investigator who took an interest when he read that a copy of To Kill a Mockingbird was found on the body of the young man from the wrong side of the Toledo tracks. I took my beer from the passing waitress and moved toward the battered upright alongside the bar. More than a few faces watched my approach. It was time to introduce the Boy Howdy Boku Good Times Lounge inhabitants to live music and to the wonders of James P. Johnson, Fats Waller, Joe Turner, Art Tatum, and the Harlem Stride. Real soul music.
"Rise and shine, Buttercup."
I raised my hat from the side of my head, just far enough to see two handcrafted Paul Bond boots and two knees, one real, the other artificial. I lowered my hat, effectively blocking the view.
"Go away."
He kicked the underside of my bunk.
"Get up, we got work to do."
Lucian Connolly had been sheriff of Absaroka County the 24 years previous to my administration. He was a rough old cob who had lost his leg to Basque bootleggers back in the 50s, the prosthetic of which I was preparing to twist off and use to beat him to death.
"I worked all night, old man. Now go away."
"Yeah, well, you didn't do too good a job, because your Indians over at Durant Memorial taking the place apart."
I raised my hat again.
"What?"
"He come to, and he's over there paying him back for Sand Creek."
I hustled off the bunk. "He's Crow, not Cheyenne.
He's one pissed-off Indian, is what he is."
It was a disaster. The ER staff, assuming that the EMTs had given the wounded man a sedative, had rolled him into an examination area and left him until an overworked internist could get to him. A child with an ear infection, an elderly man with chest pains, and a woman going into premature labor had distracted the doctor. In the meantime, the slumbering giant had awakened. Luckily, Double Tough and two of the HPs were still at the hospital when the excitement began. He had thrown the gurney and then began yanking very expensive machinery to throw next. They had charged him en masse, only to be plucked off one by one, like the gurney and the pricey machinery. The tide shifted when Freymeyer joined the fray, and the four men were able to